Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is China. Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss how President-elect Joe Biden might navigate the U.S.-China relationship are Elizabeth Economy and Adam Siegel. Liz is a senior fellow for China Studies at the Council and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. She has written widely and well on Chinese domestic and foreign policy. Her most recent book is The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Adam is the Ira A. Littman Chair in Emerging Technologies and National Security and the Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at CFR. He is the author of The Hacked World Order, How Nations Fight, Trade, Maneuver, and Manipulate in the Digital Age. Liz and Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us on.
Great to be here, Jim.
I want to discuss how a President Biden will likely handle relations with China. But before we go there, I'd like to begin with your assessments of President Trump's China policy and what kind of inbox he's leaving behind for a President Biden. So Liz, maybe you could go first.
Sure. I think at this point, we're really almost perched on a precipice of a Cold War with China. President Trump and his team really completely upended our traditional policy toward China, moved away from a policy of engage or engage but hedge to one that I would call compete, counter, and contain. You know, they identified China as a strategic competitor, but also a revisionist power, one that was bent on undermining or overturning the current rules-based order. So battle lines have been drawn. You know, we're looking at China now not simply as an economic competitor, but also as a strategic and even ideological challenge. So I think battle lines have been drawn and they're hardened. Every issue has become a litmus test for whether you're with us or against us, whether we're talking about, Huawei or Xinjiang or Hong Kong. So, you know, we're almost at a point where the world is looking as though it might be bifurcated into, you know, one that's led by China and perhaps Russia, and another that's led by the United States and its Asian and European allies. So I think President Biden is going to face a pretty challenging situation with China as he takes office in late January.
Adam, let me bring you in here. Do you share Liz's assessment that the Trump administration has set up this compete, counter, and contain policy?
I do. I think across almost every issue, the Trump administration really pushed back hard on China. I am also struck by how increasingly it's an ideological battle. If you look at the last series of speeches given by National Security Advisor O'Brien and Secretary of State Pompeo, increasingly they talk about the Chinese Communist Party as an existential risk to the United States and the idea that China is, you know, not only undermining the liberal order, but beginning to spread digital authoritarianism, taking advantage of corruption and all these other things. I am slightly less convinced that it's going to be a bifurcated world, though. I think there is going to be a significant amount of pushback from countries that can about choosing sides. I think they will want to try and play, much like other countries did during the first Cold War, try to play the two sides against each other. And I have increasingly been describing it as a battle over networks, trying to control different systems, but systems that still touch each other.
Now, Liz, I note that China was quite slow to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory. He waited nearly a week after the election was called to do so. Should we make anything of this?
I don't think that we need to think too deeply about it. I think, a number of countries didn't step right up to congratulate President-elect Biden. I think people were waiting to see, you know, what might happen. I think, you know, certain countries, and China might be one of them, also didn't want to risk challenging President Trump or upsetting him further unless it was going to be absolutely necessary. And so, you know, I don't think that there was any big strategic thinking behind this. I think it was a little bit of a wait and watch and see exactly how this election was going to play out. I don't think they wanted to be first out of the box until they had a greater certainty about what was going on.
Well, let me ask you a related question then, Liz. Do you think there is any chance that the Chinese might alter their behavior given the change in the occupants of the White House? I mean, taking the note that Biden is going to approach it differently than Trump did, do we anticipate any effort by Beijing to try to prevent perhaps a softer, less assertive face to the world than it has recently?
Well, I think I've had some interactions with Chinese colleagues over the past few weeks. I think they believe that China has already sort of dimmed the wolf warrior diplomacy profile.
You should explain the wolf warrior metaphor, since it's come up a lot, and I'm not sure many people know where it comes from or what exactly it means.
Sure. There were a couple of movies where Chinese military officials, Chinese PLA people managed to overcome the U.S. and others. And so it was a kind of a triumph of Chinese and wolf, and they were termed wolf warriors. So the diplomats now have this wolf warrior diplomacy that we saw come into full bloom over the course of the pandemic, where they're very assertive, right? So the idea is basically that China is not going to sit back and be, you know, humiliated. It's not going to take any insults from anybody else. It's going to fight back. And so Chinese diplomats, a number of Chinese diplomats sort of assumed this posture of wolf warrior diplomacy. But, you know, it had a very negative impact on China's reputation globally. And so even as China was delivering a lot of the personal protective equipment, you know, throughout the sort of second half of the pandemic, it managed to alienate a lot of the recipients of it because it was so aggressive in demanding thanks, you know, or saying, if you don't thank us, in fact, we're not going to give you any PPE. You know, now it's in the midst of a trade war with Australia because Australia sought an inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. So this is the kind of wolf warrior diplomacy that China has been pursuing. But in any case, you know, a number of my colleagues have said that they've really taken a step back from that. I'm not sure that that's true. I think we've seen some recent indications that it's still very much in play. But I think that's one thing they're planning to do. I think another is we've seen Xi Jinping step up and indicate interest in joining the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the sort of revised version of the old Trans-Pacific Partnership that the U.S. pulled out of at the end stage negotiations at the outset of the Trump administration. So I think that's a positive step that China's trying to make. We saw Xi Jinping put forward this idea about using a QR code to try to get travel going now as some countries are coming out of the pandemic. So I think China's trying to position itself in a more positive way. You know, whether they do anything on a bilateral level in terms of just with the United States to try to make some noteworthy concession of some sort, I think is less likely. I know that the leadership asked for ideas from a number of think tanks and universities a few weeks back. So ideas are perhaps percolating, but so far all I've heard coming out of that are pretty tepid ideas. Things like, well, we can help the United States with their pandemic response. I don't think that's the kind of initiative that the Biden administration is going to be looking for that would signal some kind of reset in the relationship.
Let me ask you, Adam, do you see any evidence that Beijing may sort of change tack? Now, note Liz brought up the Australians. It seems to me last week, the Chinese sort of upped the tensions in their confrontation with Australia. So I guess that's one in the column of not offering up an olive branch, but maybe you're seeing some things out there that we should take into account.
I think Liz is right. I don't see it on the bilateral front. I see lots of rhetoric about China being a responsible player on the multilateral level and still kind of supporting a type of globalization that benefits all. I do think that the Chinese will hope, given, you know, President-elect Biden's past views of China, which were deeply centered in the engage and hedge school, that they can signal with some of the issues that the vice president said were important to him, working on clean energy and tackling transnational problems, that they can somehow signal that they are open to working on those things and trying to come to some modus operandi with the Biden administration. Now, I think there's a lot of pressure from the Biden administration, from both Republicans and China hawks in the Democratic Party, to make sure that they don't look like they're making any type of deal there. So I think that'll be very hard to do in the first 6 months to a year. But I think China will continue signaling on those things, hoping that they can gain some traction.
Well, Adam, let me draw you out on your point about Joe Biden historically belonging to the engage and hedge school, and ask you sort of to comment on whether you think a President Biden is going to be practicing engage and hedge, or whether the events of the last 4 years have sort of led to a reorientation in the president's thinking and a reorientation of what his administration is likely to do. I will note just as context that there certainly seems to be a fair amount of hostility to China across the aisle on Capitol Hill. Maybe you could just sort of set up for us what sort of view you think President Biden will have toward China.
Yeah, I think he's already signaled that he is in the mainstream now. And as you said, the mainstream is much more aggressive, as Liz described it, you know, compete, contain, and counter. I mean, he referred to the Chinese leadership as thugs. And he has, I think, signaled that he will continue to, I think, maintain these three C's. I think it's both a change in view, you know, partly socialized by the people around him. I think it's a political reality. I think he knows he will be attacked both by the Republicans and by hawks in the national security hawks in his own party. Some of it will be the Trump administration leaving the White House. You know, they are putting many things in place that will make it difficult to reset the relationship right away. I do think that this is here to stay, and I think Biden will embrace it. He has many people around him that were early proponents of it from the Democratic Party, and they will continue pushing many of the same policies with different approaches.
Liz, can I ask you the same question? What sort of general view do you think we're going to see coming out of the gate with the Biden presidency?
I think that probably the Biden administration will have a couple of different approaches that will be relevant to China. So I think on the one hand, there will be an effort to reestablish some kind of bilateral diplomatic framework for engagement. So that really has atrophied under the Trump administration. You know, we haven't had broad-based political discussions. We've really only had the trade negotiations. And to some extent, you know, we've had some discussions between our two militaries on crisis management. But, you know, there is no real effort behind any kind of political dialogue or strategic dialogue. And I imagine that that will be reestablished in some form. I also think, as Adam suggested, that on the issue of global challenges, whether we're talking about the pandemic or climate change, there will be an effort to reach out to China, probably to push China to do more. You know, so it won't simply be about reaching out to find areas of cooperation. And certainly there will be no trading off of things. You know, we'll give you this if you do more on climate change. I think there will be the expectation from the Biden administration that the direction in which China is moving in the near term in terms of its CO2 emissions and its export of coal-fired power plants, that all of that needs to stop now. So I think there will be an element of pressure that comes out of the Biden administration, but at the same time, a signal that the U.S. is going to take this issue seriously again, step up with us, and, you know, let's, you know, bring, you know, climate back to the fore in a meaningful way. So I think there will be some, you know, effort on that front to find areas of cooperation. And then finally, I think, and we've already seen evidence of this, there is going to be an effort to stitch together, I think, a new kind of coalition, you know, centered on democracies. And there's been a lot of talk about President Biden hosting a, you know, democracy summit. And again, I think this, you know, is music to the ears of the Europeans who have been waiting for a return of a president who will be more multilateral, who will be, you know, more interested in engaging with Europeans in a positive way. But I think also President Biden will have to do a little bit to reassure our Asian allies, because, you know, it may come as a surprise to some, but actually the Trump administration has had a pretty good relationship with Japan, with Vietnam, with Australia, maybe to a lesser extent, South Korea. But I do think the Biden administration will want to reassure our Asian partners that our commitment in the region will remain strong and that we're not changing policy toward China, that we continue to view China as a significant, you know, regional challenge.
Adam, I'd like to draw you out on the last point that Liz made about the Biden administration's belief that it's going to be able to rally America's allies to form sort of common cause against China to curtail Chinese power. We saw elements of that back during the Obama administration with the pivot to Asia, the creation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was offered up not just as an economic deal, but as a strategic arrangement that was going to constrain, nudge China. As you look at America's allies, and particularly those in Asia, who do you see as sort of standing up and willing to join such an effort? And who do you look at and say, well, they're actually really concerned about getting caught in the middle and they want to really sort of play both sides of the fence, as I think you mentioned earlier on?
Yeah, I think, you know, Liz is right that a lot of the beginning work is reassuring people that the Trump administration did a pretty good job of working closely with. So, you know, Japan and India and Vietnam, I think, are already a little bit nervous about Biden. And Taiwan seems to be a little nervous about Biden as well. Clearly, most of the smaller Southeast Asian states, that is really how they have always acted. They will be happy if they see, you know, another statement about pivot to Asia. And I think what they'll be looking for is, you know, one of the things the Trump administration didn't do was engage on the diplomatic front, right? So they weren't sending high-level officials to ASEAN meetings and the things that are important to ASEAN countries. So I think they'll be happy to see that. But I don't think the economics of countries like Thailand and others are going to change dramatically. And they're going to still, I think, very much either tend towards Beijing or try to balance the two. I think Singapore is one that we can certainly engage in a lot more there, in particular on digital and technology issues, because Singapore also doesn't want to have to make a choice between the two, but also sees itself as increasingly important as a safe space for governance of technology and data issues that should look more like the U.S. than it should look like China.
I'd like to actually talk about some specific policy issues, if we may, because obviously you can have the broad attitude that the Biden administration has to the relationship, but a lot of that policymaking is going to be made over very specific issues. And there seems to be no shortage of regional issues as well as global issues. Maybe we could do some of the regional issues first. And one that comes to mind is Taiwan. It seems that the Chinese have sort of increased their pressure on Taiwan in recent months. It's a potential flashpoint. How do you see a Biden administration, Liz, handling the issue of Taiwan?
So I think one of the things that the Trump administration did was really to elevate the issue of Taiwan in a way that we haven't seen before. And they did this in conjunction with Congress, who's always been a mainstay of a pretty proactive and positive policy toward Taiwan. But, you know, a number of new policies and initiatives like the Taiwan Travel Act and, you know, sort of increasing the number of senior officials that would travel to Taiwan, you know, threatening to cut off relations or economic relations with countries that de-recognize Taiwan, introducing Taiwan into some of the free and open Indo-Pacific initiatives, setting up Taiwan as a model of democracy, and really, I think, highlighting Taiwan's response in contrast to that of China throughout the pandemic. Both countries in the end did extremely, well, nation, I should say, Taiwan, did extremely well. But of course, we're a fan of Taiwan. It's a democracy, and they managed it somewhat differently. So I think elevating Taiwan in that respect as well. The arms sales have been robust to Taiwan. And, you know, Trump administration changed the policy where we only sold arms, you know, once a year. Now it can be continuous. So I think they put in place a lot of different measures and policies that, as Adam suggested earlier, it's going to be difficult for a Biden administration to unwind, especially given, again, Congress's very strong support for Taiwan.
Excuse me, Liz, but will the Biden administration want to unwind some?
I don't think so. I don't think they're going to want to unwind them, but I'm not sure they're going to want to push further. I think probably the most significant shift that we would see coming out of a Biden administration with regard to Taiwan would be tamping down on the rhetoric. I think there are certainly going to be some people in important positions in the administration who are strong supporters of Taiwan and who will continue to want to you know, help Taiwan to bolster it and to try to bring in other countries to support Taiwan, which was also an initiative of the Trump administration. I think that's going to continue, where a Biden administration will reach out to other partners and to try to bring Taiwan into regional or even global groupings around democracy, for example. So I think all of that will continue, but I think they'll try to take down the temperature. And I think we're not going to hear a lot of big announcements about Taiwan, big new initiatives. And if we do things, I think, you know, it'll try to be a little bit more about, you know, talking softly and carrying a big stick, as opposed to, you know, talking very loudly and maybe not carrying such a big stick.
Adam, you're welcome to weigh in on Taiwan, but I'm also curious on what you think the Biden administration might do in terms of the South China Sea. Obviously, under the Trump administration, we had freedom of naval operations ongoing. Do you see the Biden administration continuing that, scaling it back, doing something different?
So I'll just add on Taiwan. I think Liz is right on all those things. I think the other thing that the Biden administration will want to continue from the Trump administration is discussions on supply chain security, and in particular, focus on semiconductors, because TSMC, the Taiwanese producer, is such an incredible linchpin of the whole industry. And U.S. pressure on TSMC was really key on kneecapping Huawei and helping turn the decision on 5G networks in many European countries. And so I think we'll see a greater coordination on supply chain security issues and redundancy on those. I think on the South China Sea, we're going to see a continuation. They're going to continue the freedom of naval operations, and there will probably be an attempt to do some increased military exercises and sharing of information, and in particular, kind of sensing capabilities. So, you know, some of the ASEAN states don't have the ability to track Chinese vessels all the time, and so there'll be some, I think, desire to help share those technologies. You know, there's not a huge amount of great policy options on the table, but I think what they will also want to address, you know, what people call China's gray zone operation. So the Chinese using either fishing vessels or Coast Guard vessels to harass others. And so I think they'll want to coordinate as well on that side.
Adam, on that point, do you think the risk of a direct U.S.-Chinese confrontation in the South China Sea is high?
It's not zero. I mean, I don't think it's particularly high. I think, you know, we've certainly had a number of situations where Chinese vessels and Chinese planes seem to be engaging in behavior that is dangerous and coming too close to U.S. vessels. That always has the potential for causing an accident and a crisis, like as we had with the EP3 incident a little more than a decade ago.
It was 2001.
2001.
It was one of the first crises under President George W. Bush.
Right. So two decades ago. But I do think, given Liz's earlier point about how the Biden administration will try to re-engage on broader strategic and military and political conversations, that those are the types of discussions that will help prevent those types of accidents from happening, hopefully.
Liz, another issue I wanted to ask you about is Hong Kong. Obviously, Beijing has cracked down on Hong Kong, the new national security law. The question, I guess, facing a Biden administration, is there much, if anything, it can do about the future that Hong Kong seems to face?
I think the options at this point are quite limited. We played out our hand with the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. We pulled Hong Kong's special status. Would there possibly be some leverage there in talking about giving back the status if Beijing were willing to, you know, reduce the pressure politically on Hong Kong? My sense, frankly, is that Xi Jinping doesn't really care what the United States or the UK or any other international actor tries to do with regard to Hong Kong. It is an issue of sovereignty. And he's signaled, frankly, for the past several years that interfering in this was just a non-starter from his perspective. He even has said, you know, not too long ago that the influence of the UK over Hong Kong, you know, ended at the time of the handover, which, you know, technically isn't true because there is a joint declaration and a basic law and all sorts of things that actually, you know, give the UK the right to engage legally on issues related to Hong Kong. But I think that gives you a sense for the mindset of Xi Jinping. You know, one thing that the United States can do, of course, is to open its doors the way that other countries have to, you know, immigrants from Hong Kong, right? To welcome a much larger number of people to come here. And I think that's something perhaps the Biden administration would consider doing. President Biden has already indicated that the door is going to open again for greater immigration to the United States, you know, returning to one of our founding principles. So it's possible, I would think that maybe that's one thing that we could do there. We're going to have to decide whether we think that engaging with Hong Kong again, you know, giving it special status, is any way to help protect it. It's not clear to me that it is, unfortunately. So I think our best option at this point is to continue to signal to Beijing that along with many other countries, we are watching what they're doing, and then to offer an open door to the people of Hong Kong.
Adam, do you have any reason to be optimistic about what the United States can do for Hong Kong?
I don't. I think it's pretty bleak. I think perhaps they could go a step further and, you know, use something like the Magnitsky Act or some other sanctions against individuals who they, you know, believe are leading the persecution and the prosecutions of Hong Kong democracy activists. And I think that's probably the only other tool that they have in place. But other than that, I totally agree with Liz.
Okay, I want to shift shift now and talk about, let's call them transnational issues, and really sort of delve into the expertise that each of you has in your scholarly work. And I want to talk about climate change, and I want to talk about technology. So maybe, you know, Liz, we can talk a little bit about climate change and the issue of global governance, because you've already offered it up as one area in which we might see some cooperation between the two capitals. Maybe you could sort of flesh it out a bit for us and what it is precisely we think the Chinese might be willing to offer or do if the United States made the right proposal to it.
Sure. I do want to point out, though, on the issue of Hong Kong, we have already sanctioned some Hong Kong officials. So we have levied some economic sanctions on Carrie Lam, for example. So I think Adam's right. We could extend that to others, but it is a tool that we have already put into play there. I think on the issue of climate change, you know, I don't know that it's up to the United States to make a big proposal to China at this point in time. I think the United States needs to get itself back in the game to begin with. Obviously, we're going to get back into the Paris Climate Accord. We're going to not pull out of it fully. So that's step one. I think we're going to have to make some sort of pledge of our own looking ahead. Already Japan, China, you know, many countries now have put out, you know, carbon neutrality by 2050 or carbon neutrality by 2060. So I think the U.S. is going to have to, you know, step up and indicate what it's prepared to do to address climate change. The good news is that over the past few years, our contribution in terms of CO2 emissions has actually gone down overall. So we had a little bit of a spike and then it's gone down. So we're actually heading in the right direction and our coal use has actually gone down despite President Trump's desire to revive the coal industry. So we're actually moving too slowly, of course, but we are moving in the right direction. In terms of real cooperation, I think we're past the point perhaps of, you know, transferring technology to China, you know, which would have been, you know, some of what we might have been talking about certainly 5-7 years ago. I think it's going to be about what is it that the two countries can do in terms of really pushing forward on more ambitious targets for both countries, since we don't have an ambitious target yet and the Chinese is not ambitious enough. And then are there things that maybe we can think about in terms of global development? And so the Chinese, as I mentioned earlier, are exporting, you know, over 100 coal-fired power plants globally through the Belt and Road Initiative. The Obama administration, you know, signed onto a pledge that it was not going to support financing through Exim Bank or anything of any coal-fired power plants globally. So we're already out of that game. China needs to get out of that game as well. In addition, you know, China domestically is building a lot of new coal-fired capacity. So I think holding China to account, you know, Xi Jinping has stepped up and said, we want to be, you know, a global climate change leader. And they kind of get away with that because they do invest a lot in renewables and are increasing the role of renewables in their overall energy mix. But they've got to do more in terms of their own coal production and their export of coal. So I think a combination of cooperation in terms of setting ambitious targets and then bringing pressure to bear on them in terms of their own domestic coal use and export of coal would be perhaps something that the Biden administration will put forward.
Adam, could I draw you out a little bit about the technology battle and this talk of decoupling? You've already made a few remarks about it, but I think there's a lot more there. Perhaps you could give us some sense of where you think the Biden administration is going to go in this field and to what extent it is going to simply carry out a policy that the Trump administration has already begun.
I think a lot of it will be following through on things the Trump administration started. So certainly some technology sectors, they are going to continue the decoupling process. I think semiconductors is the main one, but also probably health data and other types of data that would be sensitive about U.S. individuals. So any kind of big data systems that touch on U.S. individuals in a sensitive way. I think they're going to be less likely to frame all technological advance in China as a threat to the United States, but they will still see it as competition, and they will focus more on the domestic side than the Trump administration did. So, you know, greater funding for basic R&D and more use of industrial policy tools if they can get the Senate on board to support certain types of sectors. And as we mentioned before, more multilateral. So they will work hard, I think, to try and close the gap between the U.S. and Europe on how data is governed on privacy issues. So then they can begin to pressure China internationally and hopefully bring in other countries that China is now reaching out through the Digital Silk Road or other efforts to bring them into a more U.S.-European regulatory kind of framework.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic, Adam, on the potential for closing the gap between the United States and Europe? And I ask that against the backdrop of a lot of talk about how Joe Biden, a Biden presidency, is going to reinvigorate the transatlantic alliance. We're going to, in some sense, get the team back together. We're going to go off and do big things. Do you think that's likely to hold once we go from the meta level of aspiration to the devil in the details?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. The task force that the council did on U.S. innovation and national security suggested it. I'm not sure how well it's going to work. I am, you know, as I think your question implied, there are longstanding cultural and political differences about how we treat data between the European Union and the United States. And certainly there will be goodwill on both sides. There'll be a willingness to discuss these issues, but it's not clear that these things disappear right away in a new Biden administration. Clearly they don't. And the language out of the European Union right now, when a lot of it is focused on digital sovereignty, which means independence both from Chinese hardware and from U.S. platforms, from U.S. software. So we will still have some significant differences with the Europeans on digital taxation and data localization, this Gaia X, which is their cloud initiative. But I do think we will at least be talking, and the two sides will be looking for efforts to close that gap. So that overall is a positive. It won't be easy.
I'd like to close our conversation by asking the two of you to peer a bit into the future. If we were to get together a year from now, sort of do an assessment of the first year of the Biden presidency on China, how do you think we would describe it? Would we be talking about renewed engagement in U.S.-Chinese relations? Would we be talking about an era of continued confrontation between the two? Something else? Liz, maybe you can go first.
Sure. I think we would be talking about a Biden administration that had reached out far and wide to try to knit together a coalition, not just among like-minded democracies, but also more deeply into developing economies in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia to ensure that where China is attempting to upend the current rules-based order, that there is a strong bulwark against that. And so in some respects, a continuation of Trump administration policy, but at the same time, an effort to ensure that the U.S.-China relationship doesn't continue to spiral down, that it's not in a free fall, that there is a strategic vision of where we want to be with China, you know, 5 or 7 years out, and that it's not simply about pushing back against every perceived and real threat without a sense for where this is going to take us. So, you know, we may have a few areas of cooperation, I think, to, again, put a floor under the relationship, but I don't see the United States returning to the era of engage or engage but hedge that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. At best, I think it will be hedge but engage. You know, that would be, I think, the best at this point that the Chinese could hope for.
Adam, yourself?
Yeah, I suspect that a year from now, it looks a lot like it does now, quite honestly. I think the Biden administration will, you know, as Liz said, and we've been talking about throughout the podcast, that there will be big signals on the coordination and the alliance side. There will be attempts to bring everyone together. There probably will be an attempt to meet with China early on to set the tone. I think there'll be a lot of pressure to look tough on China. I do think that, you know, domestic problems, COVID and other things mean that there will be very little change in that first year, that the guardrails are kind of in place for the relationship on the competitive side. And, you know, they will look for some, I think, early actions that they can signal that they're going to still be tough on China. Maybe, you know, some of the tech things that the Trump administration doesn't get done on their way out the door. But then, you know, perhaps at the end of that year or moving into the second or third year, they'll be in a place to, I think, maybe begin to shape a different relationship moving forward.
On that note, I'll close up the president's inbox for this week. My guests have been Liz Economy, Senior Fellow for China Studies, and Adam Siegel, the Ira A. Lippman Chair in Emerging Technologies here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Liz and Adam, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with Senior Producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.